That's it, that way.
Yeah, I get some really large deep soup. That's okay, a beautiful day out here.
There's quite a few rally mounts in county.
How's it in Seattle?
It's a little bit further north.
Yeah, Rockland County has a lot of snow.
Yeah, it's on the side. It's where the track has pushed the snow up to the side, where, you know, where the cars had to unbury themselves. But it's starting to melt. It's beautiful today. It feels like it's going to be, I don't know, it feels like there's not going to be any more snow. It's has that spring feel in the air. It's beautiful out. Today's a good day for a run.
All right, so should we get everybody's in line, I think, right? So we can get started?
It's okay with me. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to finish up chapter 5 today. We have two more verses. Okay, so we left off with 5:17, where King Solomon was saying that the real good is not the imagined, but what you really partake of, and that it's important that the person really enjoys what he works for, because he said that in 17. He says, behold what I have seen, meaning he says, behold what I have seen is really the good, and his conclusion on this, this specific point, is that it is proper, it is pleasant that a person eats and drinks and sees the good in all of his labor. So eating and drinking means that he partakes of what he labored for. B'chol amalo means all of his labor. That means he benefits personally from everything that he labored. There's nothing that he labored for and is left over, because that's what causes the anguish in the person. And here, when he says that he eats and drinks, and he says an additional thing, which we didn't point out last week. If you notice, he says he eats and drinks, and he sees the good. So that could mean, I was wondering if that means also that he reflects on himself, that there's a reflection of the good that he has, because that's also a part of it. It's not just the experiential part of good, where a person removes hunger by eating, or you know, things of that nature, or if he's, you know, has cabin fever from being in the house all winter, so he takes a drive. So then he experiences, you know, the nice expanse and the sea and the sky and the mountains, so that's pleasant. But there's also another thing that he can reflect. When he reflects on what he has, he reflects on his state. He assesses where he is in life. So there also there's a satisfaction, because this person has a need. There's a need for progress. There's a need for a person reflecting that he has, that he's in a good state. The person wants to have a feel that he's in a good place. You hear people say that sometimes. But that's only because a person reflects and he assesses, you know, what is going on in his life at this moment. Where is he standing? So it's not just the experience that offers a person satisfaction in terms of the senses, whether it's the appetitive drive or the sexual drive or whatever the needs that he has that he, you know, by rights is being created by God, and that way he is supposed to satisfy himself. But it's not only those sensual satisfactions or even the psychological satisfactions that he needs. Then there's also one other one, and that is that he sees himself as having the good. Right, it's a very subtle point, but I think if we just think about that, that is true. We do that. And you know, there's so many thoughts that we have in our mind during the day, but this is something which I think is regularly, especially as a person matures and gets older, and one accomplishment after the next accomplishment, and he senses the satisfaction of high school graduation, college graduation, the first job, the first paycheck. So that stirs the person to reflect and to feel a certain amount of pride, which is important. That's why God created pride for those moments. And that could be a very good thing to keep a person on the right path, that he's sensing a satisfaction at where he's at. Okay. So he says the person... this is something which comes from the fact that he consumes all of his labors, the products of all his labors. That means that there's a satisfaction that's met with that too, when what he creates, he consumes. Because if, like again, like we said, if there's leftovers and there's anguish, he's worried about maintaining it and so on and so forth. But there is the, you know, that satisfaction that, you know, I made this and I'm enjoying it. A person labors over, he takes a week to build himself a wooden chair. And the armrests and the seat and the back and the legs and everything. And he finally sits in it, it's solid, and now he enjoys the chair, and he's going to enjoy that chair more than other chairs that could be identical, because there's a satisfaction in the fact that he labored for something that he needs. There is a satisfaction there.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So there's one point about that that bothers me, and that's the part about, well, if he has too much, then he has anguish. I understand the one case that's quoted out of the Talmud where the guy was going to die and had, you know, like a cup of carobs left over.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in general, we don't see that principle operating in man. I think men are generally happy when they have more left over, and they don't really stop and think about the fact that they labored for nothing.
Right, so the person's making a mistake. Because if a person was really honest, he would, and evaluated his time learning, he would regret having labored more than he actually consumed. He could have used that time and labor, time advancing his mind to another idea of truth. I mean, it depends. Yeah, I hear
the verse is telling the ideal, not the reality.
Yeah, this idea is, well, there's also the reality, too, that even the people who have the satisfaction of having extra money in the bank, but there is also the reality that, like he says in verse 16, that all his days he eats at night. Why? Because he's working, toiling all day long, and he doesn't get to stop and eat until the nighttime because he's just looking to amass, you know, a lot of money. And then he has a lot of anguish because he may have money in the bank, but he's talking about another aspect that ruins that sense. It may be, on the one hand, there's a satisfaction of, you know, seeing a nice bank account with, you know, many zeros after the numbers. But he's not talking about that. He's talking about, let's look at the whole person. The whole person in his daily activities is not happy. He's not eating until the nighttime. He has a lot of anguish because he's worried about, you know, protecting his investment. So it's not rejection of what you're saying. It's you're saying an idea which is true. The only thing is, that's not all of man. You have to look at the entire, all the attitudes that a person carries around in his mind. Now let's see, what's the sum total? I mean, don't you agree that the people that are, they are doing this type of lifestyle, they're toiling, they're laboring, and there's a lot of stress and those on, and they do have the money, but how often during the day do they get happiness from reflecting on the bank account, and how much of the day, on the other hand, are they stressed out because of how much labor they have to put in?
You know, I completely agree with you. No argument. I just want to make sure he's talking about the ideal here, not trying to say this is what men actually do for the most part.
You mean in verse 17? He's to the ideal there. There he's talking about the ideal.
Yeah.
That he would just consume and be happy with whatever he made, and each day's work he consumes, and he'll work more tomorrow. That's not the typical person today. You're right.
Right. Okay.
Right. So that's
just, thank you.
Yeah, and it makes sense that it's not the person today, because this is the new idea he's trying to educate man in 17. In verse 17 is King Solomon's observation that he's teaching us, because you're right. People don't live this way, so let me tell you what really is the right thing to do. The real thing that you would do, this is the ideal. So you're right. I'm glad you brought it up. 17 is talking about the ideal. Okay. Now we're going to take off also, Doug, in your point last week where we ended off verse 17, where it says that, again, he consumes what he labors for are the days under the sun. Right? There's a few days he has under the sun, which God has given him as his portion. So you said a good point there. You said one word, acceptance. Meaning when a person can recognize that this is his portion, He's not getting more than that. That's an acceptance. So that is something which helps the person in terms of the satisfaction. That has to be part of his picture. And there's actually a support for this in, I don't know if we mentioned last week, in Sefer Malachi, where God says that a person gives his charity and he gives his tithes, so God will empty out the blessing from heaven, and he'll pour out a blessing for a person until he has more than enough. And Rabbi Chait made a point on that it says, but the person has to be the person that has a concept of what enough is. See, a person is only going to have satisfaction if there's a point where he says, all right, that's all I need. And then there's more. Then there's that little excess, which is, to your point, that there is a satisfaction. I guess there is a benefit to that. That he has a little bit more. So maybe I'm wrong on that last point, because in Malachi it's saying that God will give a person more than enough, not the daily share. Although there's another place where the King David says that, just give me my daily bread. So we'll have to see why in another case here in Malachi, Malachi, that it says that God will give a person not more than enough. But another discussion. But for now, what I wanted to bring out is that the fact that the person has a certain point in his mind which is enough. So that's this way. If a person never has the concept of enough, so then he's never going to be satisfied. So in order to have satisfaction, the person has to have that concept of enough. Okay. Yeah, so let's see for a second. Yeah, and that we said also is that the reason why it's necessary for God to say, and test me in this one area. That's the only place in the Torah that God says, test me, and see if I don't give you, if I don't respond. Because the person parting with the money is the most difficult thing. So God says, here's the one area you'll have to test me. Give, your tithes, give you charity, he's talking about the truma. And that's going to the Kohen, the maestros, the tithes that they give. That's going to the poor also, I have to look. But since it's a difficulty, so God says, going to give you a reassurance in this one area. So you're allowed to give in order to test me to see if I don't respond. And he says, I will respond. I'll empty out the storehouses of heaven. That means the endless supply. Storehouses of heaven means the laws that control the earth. So, and he'll empty out a blessing to the person that's more than what they need. All right. Okay, now let's go further. We're now in 18. I guess we're going to venture into the two last verses in this chapter. Not that we look at the chapters, but actually it ends off on a good point that makes sense. So maybe that's why the Gentiles have made the chapter here. All right. So it says further, also all of man is that God gives him wealth and possessions, and God allows him to eat from it, and to carry away his portion, and to be glad in his toil. And this is a gift from God. Because not many people remember the days of the life. Why? Because God creates anxiety in the time of the person's happiness of the heart. A little bit of a difficult verse, 19. I'll read it again. He's saying that this is now a reason, because it's also for the word because. So let's just do 18 and 19 again, just to get the full thought. So he says, also, all of man is that God gives to him wealth and possessions, and God allows him to eat from it, and to carry away his portion, and to be glad in his toil. This is a gift from God. For not many people remember the days of their lives. Why? Because God afflicts man at the time of the happiness of his heart.
Boy, that's pretty different than the translation.
Yeah, what did you say?
So I have to take a press, and he says, also every man whom God has given riches and property and has given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice with his toil, that is a gift of God.
Okay, that's good.
And then it says, for let him remember that the days of his life are not many. So he's applying many to what he should remember. And then it says, for God is testimony of the joy of his heart.
Yes.
So there's no sense of affliction in that.
Yeah, I saw different explanations on this verse, but in order to make it, the one that makes most sense to me is how I'm explaining it to you based on the Sforno. Because verse 19 is coming to explain 18. That's why it starts off with the word because. So if you start off with 19 with the word because, that means it has to be an explanation of the previous verse, right? So the sense of it is that what is a gift from God if he allows a person all these things? And he says this is the entirety of man, which we'll have to explain. What does he mean? Because all of man. To say man's life is, you know, X, Y, and Z. But, you know, he starts off verse 18 as saying, also all of man is that God gives to him wealth, possessions, allows him to eat from it, allows him to take away a portion, allows him to be glad in his toil. And all this is a gift from God. Now, why is that a gift from God? Because not many people recall these good times. Because during the good times, as Sforno says, he says the majority of cases, I'm reading you Sforno now, doesn't mean that God afflicts his heart at the time of gladness. Because in most of the cases, at the time that man is glad in his heart because of his success to reach his wealth, God, blessed be he, afflicts him with anxiety and strivings. And in this manner, he doesn't really benefit from all the wealth. So he's saying the person who does have the wealth and the riches, and he can eat from it, and he can take away a portion of it in his hands and use it, and he can have gladness in his toil, this is a real gift. Because most cases it's not like that. That's how the reading of the two verses are. Ki lo harbe yizkor, because not many, meaning not many. Many is going not the days, but not many people remember the days of their life. Why don't they remember the days of their life? Because when you sit back and you rejoice about the good old days, they have to be good. So he says that this is not something which people do. I think Ibn Ezra actually says that. And he likes it, he says. He likes that explanation. What does he say on that? Yeah, he means to say that if a person doesn't have good in his life now, he'll try to think back on happier days. But I think the plain reading is that one second. Yeah, it's Sforno. It's Sforno throughout. That people want to remember the good, but not many people can because they didn't have the good. Because why? There was affliction at the time that they had the money. There was anxiety, there was striving, and it didn't allow them. In that manner, it did not allow them to enjoy the wealth that they had. So he's saying an interesting thing. First of all, if you look at it, there's many, many things he's telling you that take place. That's why perhaps it's a really gift from God. Because who is the individual, the single person, that not only does he have wealth, but he also has possessions, and he can also eat and enjoy it, and he can also take away a portion, and he also is glad in his toil. That means every aspect of his life, he is finding enjoyment. He's saying this is something which is a gift from God, meaning it's providence. It's something which is not most of the cases. Does that mean that, well, is it providence? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it means that if the person's living properly, then the real gift from God is how God set up the world to begin with. That if man does live properly, he will be able to have wealth and possessions, and he'll be able to eat and enjoy, take away a portion for himself, and he'll have gladness too. Meaning that the healthy individual that goes about it properly. So you could say it's not an individual case of providence, but God set up the world. That makes more sense to me that way, that God set up the world where a person will use the world properly, he'll be able to enjoy it in at every turn. But it's not the majority of cases, he says in verse 19. Because man, his own, because the way God set it up, and you see the term here is used, Elohim, for God, meaning how God designed the world. Elohim is a reference to, just in terms of justice, how God justly designed the world. So why is it that most people won't be able to have this enjoyment? Because at the time, as Swarno says, that they're trying to make the wealth, there's too much anxiety, like we said before, and the striving, and they're anxious about it. So therefore, they never get to really enjoy it. So who really enjoys it? The person who lives in the moment. That he is allowed to eat and to take away a portion. I mean, what is he doing? These individual instances are something which actually can afford the person happiness if he does it in the right measure. And you see the rabbis in the Talmud, they talk about them as how they would just work enough for that day and then they would close up shop and they would learn for the remainder. They didn't have grandiose plans. They didn't have the feeling that they were immortal and they had to build giant mansions, you know, to themselves that would outlive them and their great-great-grandchildren as well. They had a healthy attitude, a realistic attitude. And this allowed them to have less stress. They didn't have to work that much. And they were happy with whatever they needed. They were not interested in impressing other people with, you know, long driveways and shiny cars and, you know, four-story mansions. They didn't want to labor to live to make somebody else clap for them. They labored for what their needs were. And in that respect, the person to be very happy. But the person's got to create a certain level of independence that he really extricates himself from this lifestyle, because most people do have this desire to get the applause of their peers. That's a real disease. It's a real unfortunate thing. And it ruins people's lives. And I think we can now answer what it says in the beginning of 18, when I said, and he says, this is all of man. What he means to say, what King Solomon means to say over here, is that if a person can partake of the wealth, the possessions, he can eat from the food, take away a portion, and have a psychological enjoyment in the toil, that's everything. This is the entirety. There isn't more. If you're looking for more, then you're going to be upset. And if a person could meet all of his needs, these few needs, these four or five needs that he isolates and he itemizes here, so this is all of man. So this is where you can satisfy every part of your nature. And that should be it. But he's telling you this is all of man because he's trying to warn you, don't go for more. The fantasies, all these other things, that's where you're going to trip up. But think about it yourself. What are you doing each day? How can you enjoy yourself today? You need food. You need a sense of having your needs covered. You need to have psychological happiness. And that's everything he's talking about in this verse. So if you have all that, you're satisfying what you need in reality. That's why he says that is all of man. Every part of your nature is going to be satisfied, and you'll be happy. And also that means that don't try to get more than that, because that's where frustration will come in. And another point also is that the person who lives this way, these are real tangible things that he needs. But the person who's living to impress others, now he's living the fantasy. It's not the practicality. So that's a very important thing. The person doesn't try to have certain fantasies, ambitions, and things just don't work out. So he's going to be upset. And a lot of times the person himself imagines that people aren't happy with him. And it's not even the reality. He hasn't even taken any litmus tests from his peers to see are they really impressed with him or not. He'll think to himself, I bet you people aren't happy with me. I got to work more. I got to make a bigger house. So because of his own fantasy of what he thinks people are thinking, he hurts himself further. That's another you know, devastating blow that occurs to a person because they live in fantasy. They make up wrong fantasies, and then they believe these wrong fantasies are true, and then they act on those wrong fantasies. The fact is, if a person did not care what others said, that's really when other people are impressed with him. Because now they're worried. How come he's not looking for us to clap? He must be very secure. That awakens their insecurity. And then they grovel around him and they want to be his best friend. I see that. The people that are not, you know, running to applaud others, they're usually the ones that have the greatest magnetism. Other people are more attracted to them. Of course, that's not the goal. It's just psychologically. It awakens in the person that if you see somebody who's very secure and very happy, it awakens the fact that you're not, and it bothers you. And then you want to be like him. You want to hang out with him. Okay. All right, any questions or comments? Let me pause over here. This is any questions or comments here.
So this seems like if you just accept reality, then...
You'd be very happy.
Yeah, that's true.
What was that?
That's the best place to be.
Yeah, that's how we're designed. God designed us that happiness comes from being in line with what is real. That's why he gave us senses, that we can perceive clearly what is real. And we base all our decisions that they have to match up with what we sense. That's what the combination is between perception and thought. You need both. A person can't think about
something. So in verse...
Go ahead.
So in verse 19... Can you read your translation of verse 19 one more time?
Yeah, the way I'm translating it is, again, pretty much based on Sforno. And he says that, again, you got to keep in mind, it's an explanation as to why it's considered a gift from God if a person has wealth, possessions, food, happiness, and his toil, and he takes away a portion with him. Why is that considered a gift from God? Because not many people remember the days of their life. Meaning to say, not many people want to remember the days of their life because they were unpleasant. Why? Because God designed it in a way that there's anxiety and in this striving. Meaning God had afflicts man in the happiness of his heart. Meaning at the time he's happy, he's trying to go after the wealth, there's affliction there. If a person lives the wrong way. So the verse means that the reason why a person has to look at this as really a being a gift from God is because it's not the norm. Most cases, the person is not recalling the days of his life because they were painful at the time he was trying to make money. So he doesn't want to recall the days of his life. He doesn't have any good old days.
But when he talks...
Go ahead.
When it says God afflicts man in the joy of his heart, it's not like a proactive affliction, but it's the result of the fact that they are striving after something that is not the real good.
Exactly. Right. That's what Sforno says, is that God, blessed be he, afflicts man with anxiety and strivings. And in this matter, he does not benefit from his wealth. But it's not God actively doing it, right? It's not proactively. It says openly, it's man's anxiety and his strivings. It's his own doing. It's his own free will. But since God designed it, and man abuses the system, he doesn't act properly, and he goes for more than he wants, and so then this is going to be the result. But the truth is, why did God do that? See, that's the lesson. It's a lesson that you shouldn't go after that life. The pain should be a signal to the person that this is wrong, what I'm trying to do. Just like when you have the pleasant and you have serenity, that should be an indication that's a green light. That's an indication that you're on the right path. When you're struggling and when you're having anxiousness and you can't sleep and your life is not happy, it's because you're probably doing the wrong things. God didn't design a person to be unhappy. He actually designed, you know, everything that you think is upsetting. A person gets a car, and you know, you get a dent, and it starts to rust, and everything like that. Why is that? That's part of the design. The design not to invest your energies into the material life. So that's why things get older, and things break, and there's rusting. All these things to show you. Don't put your energies in here. So God will frustrate the energy. That's when God said to Adam, and this Rabbi Chait said, God will, you'll plant in the land, and the thorns and thistles will sprout up as a punishment. Because since man put too much energy into the physical, God told him not to eat from the tree. He didn't listen to God, and he went after the physical, and he thought about it. And it, the verses single out what was Eve's fantasy. She saw that the tree was pretty, it was good to eat, and she would be like a, you know, ego. She would be like gods, it says. So she took it, she ate, and she also gave it to her husband. So because they both invested too much into the physical, the response is that now the physical is going, not going to yield. When you try to plant, you're going to end up having thorns and thistles. There's going to be frustration in the physical. That frustration, Rabbi Chait explained, is in order to divert the person from sinning again like Adam and Eve. So if you're frustrated in the physical, it'll redirect you back towards the world of wisdom. So it's no accident that there's this anxiety and there's this frustration. And it is God's design. But it's for the good. It's to give you a heads up. It's a warning sign. Let's say it didn't hurt a person when they cut themselves. So they would just do things that cut themselves, and before you know it, they lost all their blood and they're dead. So pain is also something as a warning sign. I think also the way my own thought, why do you have longer sunlight during the summertime and very brief sunlight in the wintertime? Because you need more light to do your labor in the field when you can work the land. The wintertime, the land's hard, frozen, it's not yielding anything, you can't work the land. So you have less light. Why? Because the darkness is actually induces a person to learn better. And Maimonides says this as well. The person who gains the crown of Torah is the one who studies at night. Because at nighttime, all your needs are taken care of, all of your, it's not needs, your accomplishments are done. And your mind can be purely focused on your wisdom. Right? That's a typical person. Of course, a person who lives properly, even during the day. If he can put aside his accomplishments, he finished his work by 12 o'clock noon, he put in 3 hours, he has what he needs for the day, for the week, whatever it is, he's living intelligently. Now he's also in that same state. Of course, the light outside can still, and still psychologically, it could push a person towards feeling ambitious. You see a nice, bright, sunny day, it definitely gives a person energy psychologically. So the evening, for sure, is still something which gives a person more of a settled state. So it could be very well. That's how this design is continuous throughout, you know, in all creation. It's very dark now. In the winter, you know, it gets dark very early. That's a sign. There's no need to be outside now. You know, there's no working. You can't do any work in the field. Okay. Alright, so I think that wraps up the fifth chapter. Does anybody have any questions?
None here.
Okay. Let's see.
All right, so maybe we'll do, since next week is Purim, maybe we'll do something on Megillah. I'll start going through it this week. I don't think that we're having the meal out here until later in the day, so, you know, we could learn next week. My schedule is fine. So maybe you want to start looking over the story of the Megillah, maybe you have questions, and, you know, we can go over that and maybe pick out some points. How's that sound for next Sunday?
It sounds like good timing, given that we just completed this section.
Okay. I actually reprinted an article of Rabbi Chait in the Jewish Times this week. In the cover, you'll see it. So that'll give you some background and see if you can get a hold of an English translation. There are actually two articles in this week's issue, so I'm firm. And I think there's one more we'll put in next week. And all right, I mean, we still have a little time left. If anybody has any questions, you know, I'm not in any rush to get off. So when I open the floor, see, we haven't done that in a while anyway. Maybe there's some things you're learning. You have a question on a side point or something else?
I have a question. We talked about copyright issues a while back. And the question is, if you read copyright notices, even on Jewish works, even on Torah works, they will say you're not allowed to reprint any portion of this in any form whatsoever, electronic or otherwise. And so, you know, presumably the original Hebrew, say, Torah is in the public domain, but I think publishers will claim their English translation is a copyright because that's a creative work. So, and for those of us that don't read the original Hebrew, you know, we rely on English translations for just about everything. So what do you do when you're trying to write an article, give a class, correspond with someone else, or even write a book, where you want to cite even just a verse in English? Well, if you do it, you know, if you pull it out of, you know, one of these translations, technically it seems like the way they've worded it, they could say, well, you're violating our copyright. And I'm talking about someone who gives attribution. Is that acceptable and allowed?
My sense is,
I mean, obviously, if I reprinted their whole book, I'm violating their copyright. But if I'm writing a book and I say, well, Psalms 1 says this, da 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 da, and I say I'm taking this from the XYZ translation, is that acceptable?
I would say yes, because I think what they're doing is just protecting their monetary investment in their own publishing. They don't want somebody else knocking off their book. So that's really what the whole purpose of the copyright is to protect any duplication, because they labored, they put money into this, and they don't want somebody else just taking their book and duplicating it and selling it. And that would, you know, encroach on, you know, that there's a real source for that. There's a real, you know, one of the 613 commands is not to encroach on your friend's domain. Meaning to say, the literal thing is where you move the territory border.
Marker.
Yeah, the ground markers. What do they call that?
Probably boundary markers or fence posts or.
Right. So if you move that into your friend's property to enlarge yours, so that's the literal explanation. But it's used also to apply that. Person's got a pizza store on this side of the street, and I'm not allowed to open a pizza store right there. I got to go to another town. There's a lot of laws regarding that. So the same thing. There could be an area where it's not subject to, you know, geography, like a book. A book you can get anywhere on earth. So I make a book, and if somebody just copies my book, they're encroaching on the all my labor, and they're diminishing what I can make on it. But if I'm giving a class and I'm quoting an idea, a book was not meant that it should just be read and not discussed. That any author would agree to that. So in terms of discussing it and even doing a memo and giving over a copy of a segment to your students because you want to teach them, whatever the case is, I'm sure that's not something which they had in mind. They put all that wording in there because they want to have the tightest type of, you know, legalese if it comes down to somebody who really takes the book and knocks it off. But, you know, I think anybody who's an author is not intent on that the only person who read my book, he can't discuss with anybody. He can't share what he read. No, he'd be impressed if the guy would quote him on things. He'd be impressed, you know, he'd be impressed if his name ended up in some bibliography at the back of some other book that he was quoted on. So I think all those cases you're fine. There's no transgression over there.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was also curious as to whether there was anything to be read into the fact that the recent release of Rabbi Chase articles in book form
has no
copyright notice in it.
Yeah, well, I put that together, and you know, Rabbi Chase wants people to have the right ideas, so he's just the opposite. He's a true educator, and the education means that the more people can help live the right life. So, you know, it wasn't put together under any type of direction. It was really done as an honor to him, and also a great benefit to other people. So, you know, the purpose was those two objectives, really. That, you know, I thought he'd get a lot of, maybe I'm just guessing, but I'm saying I thought he would get, you know, satisfaction. I think a lot of the articles that he really worked on, he labored on a lot of those articles, you know, over the years, and that they should reach, you know, more people would be something which would be very satisfying to him. And just to have a book that has a lot of the main, you know, stories that he discussed in the Chumash, in the Torah, and in the philosophy, you know, like the different articles he wrote back in when he was working with the Noahides years ago. So he wrote a number of articles. And they're, you know, just really well written, beautiful ideas. And so it's just the opposite. Here, the idea is to, fool for a dime. I do the same thing. I never tell a person it's copyright. I say, just don't change anything. And use it as you wish.
Rabbi, what's the best way to get more copies of Rabbi Chase's articles?
Get copies of the articles or the book?
The book.
Well, he did express that he just wants it to be shared amongst people that we know. Because he didn't really go through all the articles, because only the first third of the book he wrote. The other two-thirds of the book, parts 2 and 3, were written by students. And he hasn't gone through all those things in order to give an endorsement that it can now go out to public domain. So he basically told me, give it to people that we know, that they appreciate the ideas, and they'll be, forgiving in terms of, they'll understand this. If a student wrote something and it hasn't been, edited by Rabbi Chaya, they'll be forgiving. They're not going to take him to task. There are people out there that just want to look at anything that they can twist into an attack and make an attack. So, authors open up themselves to a lot of, to be fired at, a lot of arrows. So if you know that the people you're talking about, they're, under that category, you just let me know.
Okay. I think it's a beautiful piece of work.
Yeah, it really is amazing stuff.
Yeah. You got to thank a lot of the guys who were Mendy Fader and Reuben Gover, that they spent a lot of, a lot of time, days and weeks, transcribing the classes. And then, Rebbe's himself. I mean, the first one about Torah from Sinai, it's like a real masterpiece.
Yeah. His article on faith is just, an amazing one.
It's a good thing. A lot of guys are very appreciative that now they had everything in one spot. So that was just the convenience factor. The convenience factor was really a good thing. So that's really good. And somebody else told me that he has a lot of other classes written up, but they're not in digital form yet. So I told him if you can get them into digital form, edit them and everything, we could do a second volume. So we'll see.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. right. Any other questions? Anybody else have any questions? For Doug, is there a follow-up on that, on the copyright?
No, I think that helps. Thank you.
Now, that was interesting. I was having a conversation with a friend. I put a segment of the conversation in the letters of this week's Jewish Times, and it's going back and forth. And unfortunately, this guy, Bob, he doesn't have conviction. I mean, he's brought up, you know, religious. But I remember he told me at his father's funeral that he thinks that's it. Once a person dies, there's no next world. And it seems to be the Jewish education system really failed him. But not only that, I wanted to get to the, you know, he started a whole conversation with me this week. And we're emailing back and forth literally dozens of times. And I see what's coming out in his thoughts. It's amazing how you know, a person could have such foolish ideas. Like, I'm saying this to educate people, so I'm not going to use his real name. But, for example, he felt that, you know, Maimonides and Nachmanides and Sadia Gaon and Vilna Gaon, I mean, these are people that wrote volumes. Brilliance, you know? And what is he... He impugns to these great minds that the reason why they accept the Torah from Sinai is because they were born Jewish, so they defend it. And he says, like Thomas Aquinas, you know, they'll defend whatever they're born into. So it's nothing more than just religious nepotism. And he actually admitted, yes. I did get him to the point where we're talking about, he also had this thing about external corroboration. You know, something which many people say, that, you know, you can't prove the Torah from the Torah. Which is true. We don't take the text of the Torah and say, since it says in the Torah that there were 2 million people at Mount Sinai, and there was a voice that emanated from fire, and there were these laws given, that since it said it happened, because anybody can take a book and say, since the book says it, that means it's true. We don't say that. It's important to know it's not the words that we rely on, but we rely on the verbal transmission. Because if I went to the news today and I said I was on the George Washington Bridge and there was this, you know, amazing event and there were 100,000 people there, let alone 2 million, right, there at Sinai, but there were 100,000 people or 50,000 people on the George Washington Bridge and the spaceship came down and here's this tablet that it gave me and here's the, and I even make a tablet and I go to the news and the first thing they're going to ask me is, where are the rest of these people that you say were there? And since it didn't happen, it's not going to be accepted, and it's not going to be transmitted. Certainly, 3,000 years later, it will not be something which is adopted by a nation of 6 million people. So the real proof comes from the fact that it's the only reason why we do have the story today is the only way it could have succeeded through all generations is if there were the other people that were there that agreed. And therefore, we say, since so many people agreed to it, that you can't have a mass conspiracy. And therefore, it had to occur. Sinai had to occur. You know, in contrast to all the other religions, they don't say that an event took place. They don't say they're witnesses. They just say, yeah, it's true there's billions of Muslims and millions of Christians, whatever, but they say we believe. They don't say that there was an event. That's an important thing to know, first of all. It's not the numbers of people that hold an opinion. It's you have to look at the content of the story. What is the opinion that they're talking about, an opinion that there was witnesses, there were masses there. So they don't have that. No other one has that. But he was talking about, like, you have to have a need for external corroboration. So he was like, you know, again, he seems to be working from an emotional standpoint, and he doesn't want to accept it, maybe because that's going to place a big obligation on him in terms of being religious and really having to follow everything. And he doesn't want that. And anytime I bring that up, he responds very, like, harshly, like, who are you to pick on people and say that? You can see the emotional response. It's also very indicative of if the person is debating with you on a point intelligently, or it's just an emotional position that he wants to preserve. He doesn't want to have the obligation. But I did get him to agree. So he wants to say, well, you look at all the other things in history, you know, you have external corroboration. So therefore, that makes it more plausible that it took place. So I asked him like this. I said, let's say you went to a stadium where the Mets and the Yankees had just finished a game. And you ask all 70,000 people who won. Right? And these were all Mets fans. And they all tell you that the Mets won. Now, would you believe that really the Yankees won, but there would be a mass movement to lie? So he agreed. that no, you would not get them all to fabricate because you couldn't have a common motive, that many people. You could only have a motive, a shared motive amongst a few people. But you can't get 70,000 people, let alone 2 million or 2.5 million people, to all lie about Sinai. Certainly when the story that Moses was telling them was that you saw it yourself. I can't walk over to a person and say that you saw something yourself if he didn't. He's not going to accept it. So at least at this point, this guy Bob said, you're right. I would accept the fact that if all the Mets fans came out and said that the Mets won, it had to be that the Mets really did win. Because they wouldn't really, you couldn't get them all to lie. But there is a case where there's no external corroboration. So he was able to abandon, well, hopefully I'll bring it up to him again. We have to continue the conversation. But hopefully he'll be able to now start seeing that in his own mean, his own method of thinking, in a case which has nothing to do with religious obligation, there he'll agree. So that'll be my next step with him, is to show him that, you see over here, you accepted no need for external corroboration, so why are you bringing that with the Torah? Oh, it must be because there's something which is bothering you. It irks you to have to accept it on. So it's just interesting how you can learn a lot from a person's positions, but a lot of times their positions are really in conflict. And you'll be able to show them from their own words how they really do agree with you. They do agree with the truth. It's just an interesting lesson. It could be like a dichotomy in the person's thinking. When it comes to something like it's innocuous, like sports, there he's got nothing, blocking his thinking. So he could be able to think clearly over there. Yeah, they also have the claim that there was a break in the transmission of Torah. They found it. There was a story in the prophets where they found the Torah, and it's like nobody knew what the Torah was. So if there was a break in the Torah transmission, so how can you say that we have a transmission today that Sinai took place? So to that, Maimonides, in the beginning of his Mishnah Torah, he lists the 40 generations from Moses down to Rabbeinu HaKodesh. So those 40 generations, he lists who transmitted the Torah, who to who. And that goes through that era in the prophets. So that means in the prophets, yeah, there was a group of people, or maybe a lot of people who they lost contact with Torah. But it wasn't everybody. The leaders had it. The leaders never lost it. And Moses Maimonides gives it the chain of transmission, man to man. So you have it there as a response. If that ever comes up, you should know that. At the beginning of Maimonides' work, the Mishnah Torah, he lists the 40 generations from Moses to Rabbeinu HaKodesh. And so we never lost.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm sorry. What if somebody says, fine, God came to these people and he gave them this mission, but by what right do they obligate their children to do it?
Good question. Well, the Torah actually goes into that, because it is an important point. They accepted it at Sinai, and actually the Megillah goes into it too and says that they re-accepted the Torah in the days when the Jews were in Persia, in the times of Mordechai and Esther. So even how could the parents speak on behalf of the children? All right, good question. Maybe I'll do is go into that and do that as part of next week's class.
Thank you.
Okay. Important question, Jim. All right, so when we wrap it up over here, we'll pick up next week, same time. We'll go into that question, Jim, and then also I think it will be tied into the Megillah, too. So that's a good starting point. All right?
Sounds good. Thank you, Rabbi. Have a great week.
Okay, you too, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure.